We made this.
Hi, this is Bill Smitrovich, Lieutenant Bob Bletcher on Millennium. And you're listening to The Time Is Now.
Back everyone to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Tony Black. I'm your host for this episode, an episode that I have intentionally saved to myself on this Millennium podcast. You may notice that I haven't been on the show since I think the pilot episode actually that I recorded with my guest who's joining me today, but this one I had to come back for because for me season two of Millennium starts right here. How about you, my guest today, Darren Mooney?
Hey, Tony, how are things? How's life?
It's good.
Really odd that I've been on your podcast more often than you have. It's very, very strange.
Well, this is it. I don't know if this is my podcast. I feel like if this podcast is anyone's, I'd say it's probably Kurt North's.
You know, we should also point out, like, just before that, like, it is Kurt's. It is Kurt's. Done the organizing has been fantastic in it. You're also the person who, you know, you set it up, you did the pilot, and you're like, oh, by the way, we're doing Curse of Flying Back for Halloween. Take it, Kurt. Run with it.
I'm that awful person who, like, commissioned the show, did the pilot, chose the episodes that he wants to do, and then naffed off and left everyone else to do the work, including yourself. And I think so far, I will say that I think everyone involved has done a great job, yourself included, all the guests we've had on, as well as Kurt over the last season and a little bit. So it's a real privilege to come back to talk this episode. And obviously,
welcome back to the Yellow House, Tony.
Well, exactly. It's a key one, the Curse of Frank Black, which obviously is the sixth episode of Millennium, season two, was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong and directed by Ralph Hemeker and was aired originally on Halloween, October the 31st, 1997. And in this episode is a very, very unusual piece set on Halloween, in which Frank tries to spend the evening with his daughter, but finds himself haunted by visions, portents, signs that all seem to be leading him towards a strange man from his past and his own kind of dark night of the soul, really. Before I ask you, Darren, what you think of this, I'm going to preface this episode with an admission in what I think. So I'm not even going to sugarcoat this. I'm giving this a 10 because I actually think The Curse of Frank Black is the best episode of television I have ever seen. And I've seen a lot of TV. And this is up there. And anyone who listens to the X-Cast, my X-Files podcast, our big brother, knows that I think Pusher is the greatest episode of all, which we did, you and I. But I think this is better than Pusher. So, you know, all the X-Files fans can now collapse in a heap. So that's... And I will obviously explain more, but Darren, what do you think?
Follow that.
Oh, exactly. Good luck with this. What do you think of The Curse of Frank Black?
Yeah, it's an easy 10 for me, and I'm not sure I would say it's the best episode of television ever. Thank you for that lead-in, Tony. It's great. Now I get to be the villain, no matter how much I love this episode. This would very easily be in my top 10 episodes of television ever, though, and it would be in my top 10, obviously, of the 10-13 universe as well. It's one of my favorite episodes of Millennium, and this is the thing where I have difficulty choosing. And again, when we say difficulty choosing, they're all second season episodes. Like if I have to choose, it's, you know, it's this or it's Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense. Owls and Roosters I have a huge soft spot for, and the two-part season finale as well. Those, you know, if I can cheat and count those as four episodes of television, are four of my favorite episodes of 90s television, full stop. and, you know, four of my favorite episodes in the 10-13 stable. I mean, again, this is the thing where I'm showing my hand. I'm a big Morgan and Wong fan. Anyone who's listened to the X-Cast will know that, like, my favorite episodes typically are the Morgan and Wong episodes. Episodes like One Breath, for example, Never Again, even Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man. So this is probably no surprise at all. But this is one of those episodes of television that I watched as a teenager, because I came to Millennium a bit later than I came to The X-Files. I think I mentioned this before, where I sort of, you know, I watched The X-Files, I heard that Carter had done something else, and I was like, I want to buy the DVDs and watch them. So I came to it after the fact. And it was, I loved a lot of the first season. I talked about this, you know, there's lots of really great episodes in there. You know, in particular, Force Majeure was eye-opening. The Thin White Line was beautiful. The season finale was great. Lamentation, Paris, Principalities, Thrones, and Minions were also really, really great. But it was when I hit the second season of Millennium that it was like, as a teenager, I had never seen anything quite like this. And this is coming from somebody who, you know, I'd been relatively good about watching TV shows that were quote-unquote important. So I'd seen the first season of Twin Peaks. The second season wasn't available on DVD yet, for example. I'd watched Homicide, Life on the Street, or, you know, that sort of stuff. I wasn't like, you know, somebody who'd just grown up on syndicated reruns on British television. I'd seen a little bit of television. I wouldn't consider myself an expert. But the second season of Millennium really blew the doors off. And as much as I love the beginning and the end, and as much as I love Beware the Dog, and, you know, I've got a soft spot even for A Single Blade of Grass, it was The Curse of Frank Black that really sort of showed me what the show could do. But more than that, it showed me kind of, and again, this sounds really, you know, sort of like really ridiculously absurdly kind of like self-conscious or whatever, you know, sort of like absurdly over the top, but what television could do. You know, I'd never seen an episode of television like this. And I mean, obviously there are precedents for this. Morgan and Wong in particular drew from their work on Space Above and Beyond, which I wouldn't see for years. Who Monitors the Birds, which was a mid-season episode of the first and only season of Space Above and Beyond, which has a similar type conceit. It's a largely dialogue-less, character-driven piece in which a character ruminates and has flashbacks while they're on a mission, and there's this big allegorical sort of like metaphor at the heart of it that deals with the human condition, which is very similar in structure, content, and tone to The Curse of Frank Black. But The Curse of Frank Black was just earth-shattering the first time I saw it, and what's remarkable is that every time I've come back to it, there's never been a point at which I've kind of peered behind the curtain and realized that, you know, the great and powerful Oz is just some man working a lever. Every time I come back to The Curse of Frank Black, I'm sucked in, and it's absolutely beautiful. I was half tempted to ask you to push out this podcast because I wanted to watch it again. This is somebody who has seen this probably on the bones about 50 times already. But I was like, no, I want to watch it again. But I kind of thought better of it. But yeah, it is a masterpiece. Now you're going to break my heart and tell me what it has on IMDb, right?
Yeah, I think it is a masterpiece. I really do. I think that it is unique. I don't think I've really ever seen an episode of television quite like this. Before or since, and I'm sure there are, and I'm sure there are precedents. There are certain inspirations for this, and it may well have influenced certain things. Although, because Millennium isn't massively well known, I don't know if enough people have seen The Curse of Frank Black to truly see what a magnificent piece of television this is. But there is something special about this one, and you know, I watch it every year. You know, I watch this episode every Halloween. It's this and The Shining. I watch every Halloween. It's a little bit of a tradition for me. And I've been doing that for years. So I've seen it loads of times now. I've seen it probably 20-odd times. And I watched it again today before we record. Before we were recording. And it, even though I can sort of almost have it on in the background now because I know it so well, I'm never bored. It is just... It never depreciates for me. So, yeah, it's an absolute gem of a piece. So, yeah, the IMDb rating for this. Do you want to have a guess then, Darren? Do you want to have a go at what you think this might be?
Okay, cool. So we did the first season. First season wasn't as popular as The X-Files, which meant that its ratings actually tend to be a little bit higher on occasion because obviously the people who are voting for it tend to be fans of the show. Guessing that the second season of Millennium has lower average kind of number of voters than the first season does. So I'm guessing its ratings may be slightly bumped up. I'm going to be really optimistic. I'm going to throw this out there. I'm going to say 8.8.
Sadly not. No.
What?
There are episodes that beat this one, and I'll tell you which one they are. Which ones they are.
Wait, hold on. When you said not, you mean because it's higher, right? I I underestimated how much the IMDb loved this, right? That's what you're telling me.
sadly not. In a way, I kind of wish it was 62.8, which would have fitted the episode quite neatly. but ahead of The Curse of Frank Black is the finale, The Fourth Horseman and The Time Is Now.
Okay.
Somehow Satan Got Behind Me.
I can see the Darren Morgan episodes. Ooh, that's an interesting one. I love A Room with No View. I'm really looking forward. I think I might be talking about that. I hope I'm talking about that, but it's I really like that, but still. Sorry, I'm just going to leave that hanging.
Yeah. I love that episode as well. The Mikado, which again is my second favourite Millennium episode of all time. I love that. So I struggle to quarrel with that in a way. Midnight of the Century, just slightly, and Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense. So there's quite a few ahead of Frank Black here.
Which... I guess it really is the curse of the curse of Frank Black.
I think it just goes to show, and we will no doubt talk about this in future episodes that we're going to be on together, and people will have talked about it before us, but it just goes to show how phenomenally strong this season of television is when you have half a dozen episodes that are judged better than a true masterpiece of television, you know? I mean, a lot of those episodes we're talking about are also 10s. And, you know, so most seasons are lucky if they get one 10, let alone about 6, 7, or maybe even 8, 10 out of 10s. And Millennium Season 2 has it. It's why I think it's one of the greatest TV seasons of all time. And I know you think the same. I mean, incredible. So 8.3, I think it should be higher.
I'd agree with that.
But there you go. We're on the 10 train, so you know. on that basis,
yeah, it could have got 9.8, and we'd still be like, it could be a bit higher, I think.
yeah. So let's dig a bit deeper then and talk about the Curse of Frank Black. I think I told you, Darren, on the pilot episode that my grandfather's name is Frank Black, or was Frank Black. He died nearly 20 years ago now, and. It was always Millennium was always fun to watch,
thinking that
my granddad is Frank Black, and in fact, me and my wife have joked about if we have a baby boy, calling him Frank. She actually quite likes that name, and I'm very tempted to call my future son Frank Black. But then, at the same time, in a way, I'm not quite sure I would want him to go through what Lance Henriksen's character in this in this show goes through.
I can imagine that also being a tough conversation. It's like, so who am I named for? Is it my great grandpa Frank? It's like, well, let me tell you.
Well, yes, this is a story.
Gather round, 6-year-old Frank. We're going to watch the first season of Millennium.
Yeah. Then at which point social services arrive and I never see the child again. But yeah, I think The Curse of Frank Black is for me, it's kind of where season two of Millennium starts in some respects. Not in terms of narrative, because obviously season two of Millennium has a really clear narrative arc for Frank. In fact, I think he has a very much a hero's journey arc, essentially, Frank, throughout this season. And it starts at the beginning of the end, and there are certain things that he's gone through, like Beware of the Dog, you know, and Monster and all this kind of thing already. But this one is a real sort of digs into where Frank's place is in terms of not just the narrative, but also him as a character, where he exists right now at this point where Catherine's gone. He's not in the Yellow House anymore. He's seeing Jordan every now and then, and he's caught in the middle of this increasingly sort of cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil. And I think this episode sort of contextualizes that in quite a brilliant way.
It's actually funny you should mention kind of the hero's journey and kind of where that falls, and particularly where The Curse of Frank Black falls on that, because it is the second season has this kind of almost Campbellian sort of structure to it. Particularly because, like, in the first season, and again, absolutely love the first season, lots of episodes of the first season that I absolutely adore. I mean, you can go back and listen to me rave about them. But I think that one of the, and I don't think, I'm hesitant to use the word issue, but one of the perhaps issues with getting people into Millennium was the fact that Frank was such a static character for most of the season. In fact, like episodes like Walkabout were so refreshing because you saw Frank kind of being invested and having a stakes, you know, having stakes in a story that was being told and having motivation, having something that was pushing him on. Second season, and I mean, you know, other people have talked about this with the beginning and the end and stuff like that, but it pushes Frank out of the comfort zone. It pushes Frank out of the Yellow House. It exiles him. And so it gives him an obvious kind of arc, an obvious journey. Even if you just watch the pilot episode of the season, you know, as a viewer of television, somebody who knows how stories are told, that Frank is going to end the season in a different place than he begins it. You may not know exactly what that is. In fact, I suspect nobody watching the beginning of the end had any idea exactly where the show was going to end in the time it's now. And if you did, that's amazing.
You're genius. Yeah.
You are. Like, you should be writing television. But, like, really. Even if you just watch the beginning and the end, it's clear that, like, Frank has been moved out of the house. And the only reason to move out of the house is to get him, like, to have him go on a journey where he's trying to get back to it. And I think it's interesting that you should mention The Curse of Frank Black being where Frank's journey begins, because it kind of is. You have a lot of stuff beforehand that's setting up plot points and, you know, establishing and effectively, like, re-establishing kind of Frank's character. So, for example, like, in The Curse of Frank Black, you have his love of Bobby Darin, which has been brought up, I think, in Beware of the Dog is the first time you hear him listen to Bobby Darin. And if I remember correctly, is it Sense and Anti-Sense or A Single Blade of Grass, where, like, there's a scene of Frank trying to convince the coroner how great Bobby Darin is.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of, like, re-establishing who Frank is. And even then you have the introduction of Laura Means and, say, Monster, for example. The Old Man and Beware the Dog. There's a lot of, like, place setting in those early episodes, and a lot of, like, thematic stuff that's being set up. The Curse of Frank Black is, I think you're right to put your kind of finger on it and say it's the beginning of Frank's arc, really, in terms of, like, looking at where he's going, what he's doing, and what his purpose is. And it is Campbellian in structure. I think Glenn Morgan has talked about there was some tension behind the scenes on the second season, in large part because I think Henriksen at the time, now I think he's mellowed in the years since, and he's kind of, like, having a bit of distance, has gone back and looked at the flow of the season and said, actually, a lot of it, you know, kind of works for me. A lot of it works in hindsight for me. Much like we talked about with William B. Davis, where his Handling the Cigarette Smoking Man, where he was at the time rather hesitant about it. But in hindsight, he said, well, actually, when I see everything together, take a look at the big picture, I can see how it all fits. One of those tensions was, and I think it's in Back to Frank Black, but Glenn Morgan talks about how for Henriksen was an actor who worked kind of intuitively. He really felt like he needed to feel the character and to see where the character was going and to understand psychologically where the character was going. And there was a bit of a tension because, and Morgan actually compared it to working with Duchovny on The X-Files, because Duchovny, I mean, there's a Playboy article with Duchovny where Duchovny talks about keeping Joseph Campbell books on the set of The X-Files. And, you know, he was one paper away from completing his PhD in English, you know, that sort of stuff. But you have this idea of a monomyth and kind of a character arc. And The Curse of Frank Black you can place within the Campbell arc as, I think it's called The Inmost Cave, which is the point in the journey in which the hero kind of, like, crosses a threshold to a certain extent. I'll try and dig out. I have the actual quote handy here because I did research like a sucker. Think of, like, the myths and the hero goes the underworld and they're confronted with visions. Once having traversed the threshold, the hero moves in a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms where he must survive a succession of trials. This is a favourite phase of the myth adventure. It has produced a world literature of miraculous tests and ordeals. And so, like, it's the point at which you kind of, the hero has, like, acknowledged that they're on a quest and they have to actually go ahead and, like, actually quest, if that makes sense. Think about, like, if you look at, say, Star Wars, which is the archetypal kind of, like, you know, Joseph Campbell narrative. Think about how many caves there are in there, and particularly how many caves that serve as, like, metaphorical expressions of characters' anxieties. So, for example, Rey in The Last Jedi, going into the place where the dark side is strongest and facing her own reflection. Luke in The Empire Strikes Back, going into the cave and facing, you know, Darth Vader after being in the cave with the kind of with the Wampa on Hoth, for example. And there is something very classical about that, about kind of having Frank have, you described it in the opening as a long dark night of the soul, or a long black night of the soul, if you will. But it does work, and it's, again, we talked about how great the season is, and the season's remarkable because the episode works of itself, like, as 45 minutes of television, it is amazingly constructed. But if you're looking at the season as a whole, which is not something people really did in the mid-90s with 22 episode seasons of television, but you can see how most of the pieces fit in terms of putting together kind of a larger story. And so The Curse of Frank Black is a fantastic episode of television, but it is also, as you pointed out, a big step on a recognizable archetypal hero's journey, which is one of the things that's remarkable about it.
You're spot on, and it's interesting when you look at season two, the episodes that stick out as the weakest tend to be the ones that, well, A, aren't necessarily as controlled by Morgan and Wong and the narrative they're telling, and B, very much seem to function without any of these sort of wider allusions. You know, I mean, look, you look at something like A Single Blade of Grass, which was the preceding episode, and it's probably the poorest episode of season two, really, on the whole.
Well, that or Sense and Anti-Sense, yeah.
Because they feel very much separated from the overarching things. You know, like you say, I think there is a Bobby Darin mention thrown in there, and that's fine, but it's not really any. You could take that out of the whole season and it wouldn't really make any difference. Whereas I think season two, the stronger episodes of season two, or even the most interesting ones, I mean, I'm going to be back on for The Hand of Saint Sebastian, which is very sort of schlocky and B-movie silly and clunky in many ways. But I love that because it actually does tee up Owls and Roosters, and it does continue Frank's journey in many respects, as it does Peter Watts's as well. And they're all part of a piece. And even the ones that, there are certain exceptions to this. Like I would say the Mikado is probably a strong example of a story that isn't necessarily tied to this greater sort of monomyth sort of thing going on, but it really works really well. So, you know, in that sense, when you sort of step back and examine it, there are these key points within the narrative, and The Curse of Frank Black is probably, if you take away the, like you say, the setup episodes, particularly the beginning and the end in many ways, if you take that away, The Curse of Frank Black is the first one that really just establishes Frank's place. And I think it does that right from the very beginning. I mean, the teaser is great, because one of the things I think about this episode that I love, even beyond the narrative sense and the sense of character, is just the way Ralph Hemeker chooses to direct this, I think is quite remarkable, actually, in that it's minimalist in a quite beautiful, sweeping way. I think it's the shot that really sells it and makes you realise you're in for something different is the final shot of this teaser, where the camera pans away from the door and pushes in on the
and
pumpkin.
And circles round
and
as well.
Circles like... But think about how that shot is probably 30 seconds. Like, and you think, it must be. It's getting on for that. And you think, wow, the space to be able to do that without a cut, you know, without any editing, to just have that freedom to really sort of build up. And then as well, you know, props to Mark Snow, because his score is magnificent as well.
Yes.
Throughout this episode. You know, and he really sells a lot of this stuff. And that scene is marvellous. The way it's shot, you know, the way you've got the light coming through the window, the sound effects, the car pulling away. You know, that point, it just establishes that you're in for something visual as well as mythical
and narrative, yeah.
From a narrative perspective, and quite magical in that sense. And I think it's there right from that opening.
It's an absolutely amazing teaser as well, because it has remarkably little dialogue in there. I mean, the most that I think Frank says is "dough" at one point.
Don't.
which is great. And again, this is the thing that's really, again, we talk about the season sort of like almost reinventing Frank Black, where, like, I think, again, the first season of Millennium, you know, like, I like it a lot, but I think that it kind of blows its kind of, like, you know, number of jokes in the opening episodes when, Belcher says, "Thank goodness I already got kids, while wading through a stream." That has to sustain you for 20-odd episodes. Whereas, I like the second season, and again, you can argue how much of this is like Morgan and Wong coming in and basically almost starting from page zero with Frank, and how much of it is building on what's already there. I think it's a healthy mix of the two. Like, I mean, it's quite clear that the reason that Frank, like, suddenly likes Bobby Darin for no reason whatsoever is because the Morgan family are huge fans of Bobby Darin, down to Darren Morgan being named for Bobby Darin. But I do think that, like, there's a lot of humor and warmth in The Curse of Frank Black. And again, we're going to be talking about how amazing, well, we have been talking for every episode of this podcast up to this point about how wonderful Lance Henriksen is, but this is a phenomenal showcase for him.
Yeah.
And, like, carrying an episode like this by yourself is incredibly difficult, but also carrying an episode like this, which is kind of like dark and brooding and gothic and the Dark Night of the Soul, but injecting levity and humor and warmth into it without it, like, being tonally odd or without being distracting is a remarkable feat. And, like, from that moment of him saying "dough," which is this perfect deadpan delivery, it's Frank goofing off by himself with nobody else there, it's like, I can buy Oddly enough, like, I can buy Frank having that sense of humor. Like, it's like, as long as nobody sees me, I can be a little bit playful. There's a moment later on where he's rooting through the cupboard and he says, "Now that's scary." And it's like, you can tell, like, you can buy that Frank would probably never say that in front of Peter because it would be inappropriate to do that at a crime scene. And he'd never do it with, you know, with Catherine or with Jordan because he sees himself as being a responsible father and he has to play that role. But I like the idea of, like, spending time with Frank by himself and you have, like, this internal monologue which is just a little bit more playful, just a little bit more kind of, like, spirited than you have seen to that point. I mean, even things like during the teaser, the sequence with the two kids and him going inside to get the candy for them, which is just a wonderful little human moment as well.
Yeah, and then them walking off because he's already becoming a little bit of the Crocelle kind of guy and that they're a little bit like, oh, that guy. Yeah, you're right. I think that's you're so true in what you're saying. There's a reason that, like, Peter, for instance, isn't in this episode at all, because it's almost like he doesn't exist in this world. He doesn't exist in this world of Millennium in a way. This personal aspect of Frank, you know, even though, I mean, one of the great things about this season is how their relationship changes, you know, in many ways. That friendship they have and that personal relationship really is tested and it's really fascinatingly done. But Peter's a character who is, while he's a friend, and you see it in The Hand of Saint Sebastian in a couple of episodes, while he's a friend, ultimately he tends to come, he's also in that awkward space of being a colleague, a mentor, if you look at it from the Millennium Group. You know, there's lots of different facets to those two. So him being in such a personal space like this makes sense that he's not there. Equally, you know, you couldn't have this episode with Catherine either. You know, you only see her briefly in a flashback to the pilot because the whole point of this is it's about Frank's isolation, his loneliness, his sacrifice, you know, of everything that he's had to give up, essentially, to potentially fight this greater, you know, battle and this quest, as you say, that he's on. And I think that's why it's almost like a fairy tale in a way. It's almost like he goes through this, you know, this journey throughout this one night in which and the whole purpose is that when he gets to the end and he realizes he's in danger of becoming this guy, this lonely, you know, urban suicidal, legend, essentially. Yeah. And this suicidal guy, he realizes he could become this man who he saw as a child. And he cleans the muck off the house, you know, and that's a microcosm journey of the bigger journey that Frank's on in this one episode. And I think, you know, all throughout this is expertly written, you know, whether it's, I think, to be honest, I think it's a combination of all kinds of things. I think this episode is one of those episodes that became a masterpiece because of all the different things. There was a lot in there in the script. But a lot is down to Henriksen, absolutely. A lot is down to the score. A lot is down to the direction. And when all of these things sort of came together, it created something genuinely special. And that doesn't always happen with an episode of TV. And this one, for whatever reason, just seemed to... it's hard to explain. I think there's a level of magic in it. I don't think you could create anything like this again.
Everything works. Every part of it is everybody working at the top of their game. Like, I mean, the direction is amazing. The score is fantastic. Like, when I think of Millennium, obviously I think of the theme song, but I think that that wonderful little music that's going there, the leitmotif that runs through it. Yeah, the sort of like the steady drum and stuff. The Dean Winters guest performance, Henriksen's central performance, the cinematography, the writing, just the way in which every single part of this machine kind of clicks into place. And again, you're right, it's very difficult to do. It's hard to quantify. Like, it's hard to do on a feature film where you have months of prep beforehand, you have lots of time to write and to rewrite and to audition and to do chemistry tests and chemistry reads and stuff like that, and you have an entire post-production cycle to fix it, and you can do reshoots. It's hard enough to do on film when you're working in that way. When you're working in 90s television, where, like, your job is you have basically this amount of time to get this done, and you don't get a do-over because you got to do it all again next week with 1919, and then again the week after with The Hand of Saint Sebastian. It's just, it is absolutely stunning how well this comes together. And I mean, you know, obviously this is not the only case. There are countless episodes of The X-Files, countless other episodes of Millennium where it does. But, like, something about this, everything works about as well as you could expect or ask of it, and sometimes even better in ways that, like, you hadn't expected at this point. Like, I point to that sense of humor that Frank has developed, which is not something that I ever really thought of Frank as having, but which feels perfectly attuned to what it is. Because if he didn't have that sense of humor, if he didn't make those one-liners, if he didn't sort of goof off a little bit, the whole thing might seem a little bit too heavy-handed or serious, but it's just the right amount that it's like, okay, I'm with you, but it doesn't take me out of the story. You know, to use that one example, the same thing with Mark Snow's score, it would be very easy to go overboard, to do too much on it, but it works perfectly. The cinematography, the lighting, even that scene with Krosel, at the climax of the episode, the lighting is absolutely amazing.
It's amazing,
It'd be very easy to overdo that a little bit, or underdo it. Like, to hit it, that note just perfectly is astonishing and staggering. It's phenomenal as a piece of craft.
I think the other thing as well is that this episode is really, really, it could be the one that really shows that Millennium can format break. I mean, because if you think about it, that even though season two has presented no episode that's exactly the same so far, you know, the beginning and the end in some respects was like a revenge drama. Beware of the Dog was a, you know, a strange, almost, you know,
what if dogs were serial killers?
Yeah. A really strange, offbeat murder mystery. The Sense and Anti-Sense is essentially like an X-Files conspiracy story, basically. Monster is a
Satanic Panic episode, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. A Satanic Panic episode. A Single Blade of Grass is treading the similar dodgy water that things like Tesso Does Bitch Us did.
And
the X-Files. And he's more of a straight-up sort of murder with, you know, these mystical elements. But in all of them, Frank is on a case. You know, Frank is out there investigating, even though he's with different people and, you know, it's already figured out that you don't have to put him with the same person. And season one was similar to that extent, but, you know, and there are the aspects of Peter and the Millennium Group a little bit more in the background. But The Curse of Frank Black is the first episode, I think, of Millennium at all in which Frank is not investigating anything. It's the first episode which is a night, you know, a day in the life, or in this case, a night in the dark of Frank, you know, just existing. And that's why there isn't, in a way, much plot. It is just the fact he sort of has a bit of a Halloween stroll when everything, the entire forces of fate, seem against him, you know, for this one evening. And then, obviously, a narrative appears within that. But I think that's the beauty of it, in that it's literally just at times Frank wandering down a road, looking into a house and seeing a demon watching him and things like that, and just carrying on, you know, with the wind blowing in the background. And this real, this fascinating minimalism that you wouldn't get in a lot of TV shows, even then or even now. You know, it is
certainly
unique,
not one's producing
sense.
20 odd episodes a year. Like, you might see this as an HBO show, to pick an example, on cable. Like, can you imagine going to, like, ABC or, like, you know, being on CSI, you know, and going, hey, by the way, we want to do an episode where Gil Grissom, like, wanders around on Halloween night and feels really depressed. I can imagine Jerry Bruckheimer being like, well, we'll put that in the maybe pile.
Exactly. Yeah. It's that kind of thing, in that Millennium proves that it has the space to get away with this kind of stuff, because it ultimately goes back to the fact that, really, first and foremost, Millennium is a in many ways a powerful sort of character drama about a really strong main character. And I think this season and this episode really points out that this show is Frank. You know, it could have become one of those shows that is about the cases, but really, even the first season, which is more formulaic in many ways, it always ultimately goes back to Frank, you know. And this episode really shows that the broader arc, the broader ideas within Millennium, are about Frank's personal journey trying to get from the darkness to the light. And this is a beautiful encapsulation of it all.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of interesting because it brings it back to that thing that you were talking about earlier, and this being Frank's, like, dark night of the soul. And this is the thing that I think, and again, this is the thing where Darren, you know, I'm gonna go off on one, so feel free to interrupt me. But it, like, my big overarching theory of season two, as it were, but, like, one of the things that I love about season two, and one of the things that I think makes season two such a special season of television, outside of, like, all the stuff we mentioned, where pretty much everybody is working at the top of their game in a way that is remarkably consistent and seems almost impossible when you consider like the demands of television production. But one of the things that really resonates with me, and one of the reasons why I think it works, is because it has a very clear understanding of what it's about almost from the beginning. And again, there are lots of reasons for that. You pointed out Morgan and Wong do a frankly phenomenal amount of writing on this season. Like when you're watching the season, you know, how many of those episodes are credited to either story by or script written by Morgan and Wong as well. And even those that aren't, you get a sense that there was like a, yeah, and again, like it just happens in television. It's not an insult to any of the writers. But in most of the ones that weren't, with the exception of the Darren Morgan ones, you get a sense that there was an editing hand in work there, kind of like directing and guiding it. And one of the things that I really like about the second season that comes into focus in The Curse of Frank Black, and you pointed out this idea of like it being Frank's journey, you know, from darkness into light, or trying to understand where he is in his life and what he trying to, you know, figure out what he needs to do, and making choices about the kind of person he wants to be and facing what he might become if things go wrong, is that in the second season, Millennium kind of firmly becomes a show that is about the apocalypse. Now, obviously, that stuff has been there since the pilot. We talked about it in the pilot, you know, the discussion of like the Frenchman's prophecy, the quoting of Yeats, and, you know, the prophecy and plague and all this sort of stuff in the Maritime City. And that stuff's been baked in kind of from the beginning, you know, stuff like the deal that was offered in The Judge, for example, the Polaroid stalker suggesting that things were coming down the line, the fear of, you know, sort of like great change coming in force majeure. But it was there in the background and it never really sort of clicked. And then the second season kind of throws it sharply into focus. And what the second season does, and like The Curse of Frank Black was, maybe when I was watching it, and again, maybe I was just slow on the uptake. I mean, maybe people got there before I did. But The Curse of Frank Black was the one where I really realized what the second season was doing. And again, I say that as if I realized what the second season was doing, Darren says, as he talks about a completely off-the-wall reading, which probably nobody else agrees with. And everybody's like, what the hell are you smoking, Darren? But when you watch the second season, it comes back time and time again to this idea of the apocalypse and the end of the world. But not always in a biblical sense or a global sense. The end of the world can always, in the second season of Millennium, can be both intimate and epic. It's like the destruction of the family home in Beware of the Dog, for example. It is the shattering of the sense of community or the sense of belonging or the sense of like a place being safe that happens in Monster with the accusations that kind of run through the community. It can be the destruction of a Native American tribe as it is in A Single Blade of Grass. But it is fundamentally the end of the world. The idea that worlds are dying and being reborn constantly, and that like what you're happening is sometimes the world doesn't end with a bang, with a, you know, a red sky crossover in the style of, you know, a Superman comic. Sometimes the world ends in a smaller, more kind of pathetic and more intimate way, like it does for Mr. Crosell here, you know, where he decides he can't live anymore and he takes his own life because his life doesn't make any sense to him. And that's the thing about The Curse of Frank Black and why it works so well, is it intersects the two both visually and thematically, because Frank's journey through Halloween night, like, it looks like something from a post-apocalyptic thriller. Like, there's that wonderful moment where he's walking along and he's bothered by one of the aliens from Space Above and Beyond.
The chig,
yeah, he's almost bothered by the chig. Yeah. You have a cell phone? You look like a cell phone. Frank, maybe need to work on your burns a little bit, but I do appreciate the effort. But it's this sense of, like, these big empty streets and these abandoned houses. And even when he's peering into houses, he can very rarely see people in them. He can see television, which is airing like the Notorious Seven, the infamous Morgan and Wong pilot that they left halfway through the first season to produce, which I haven't seen the Notorious Seven. I kind of want to, because they pitched it as The Godfather meets Mission Impossible. And tell me you don't want a TV show that like that.
Does sound great.
But that was never picked up, and that's why they came back for the second season. But you have, like, even when he's staring in the window where the demon is, that window is open and the house is empty as well. He's wandering down the street, he sees kids, you know, throwing eggs and stuff, but they disappear into the night. There's a lot of mist in the air. There's a sense that Frank is almost the only person in the world, or at least is completely isolated and alone, as you discuss. And you have this kind of juxtaposition where you have this beginning of the narrative that's forming. And I think The Curse of Frank Black is the first time the show explicitly suggests that the world is going to actually, literally, physically end. That there's going to be a countdown towards some sort of grand conflict between maybe the forces of good and the forces of evil. And you can see that you know, that's seeded in earlier episodes, and it's been hinted at. You had, like, Laura Mean seeing angels, for example, in Monster, looking out the window. You had the idea of some mail back in Powers from the Thrones of Dominions enforcing order on the universe. But the Curse of Flank Back is the first moment where somebody actually sits down and says, this stuff is going... this, what's happening now is nothing. Something horrible is going to happen soon, and you are going to have to choose what you do about that. And so you have this idea of the Curse of Frank Back paradoxically being what the second season does really well as a whole, which is this idea of pairing a very small, very personal, very intimate apocalypse, which is Frank losing his family, Frank losing the Yellow House, Frank losing the dream that he'd fought so hard to preserve in the first season, and watching that kind of crumble to dust and slip between his fingers, which is very human, very relatable. I mean, everybody, I think many people have faced an apocalypse like that, where you've been confronted with the reality that what you wanted isn't going to happen. What you thought you had is lost, and you have to basically pick up the pieces and figure out how to go on and how to rebuild. And you have that juxtaposed with, oh, by the way, the forces of heaven and hell are going to make war, and the earth is literally going to burn, and hell is real, by the way, and you need to pick a side because you are vitally important in this existential struggle that's taking place. And you have the two of them playing off each other, which is one of the things that I love about the second season, but it really clicks into place for me in The Curse of Frank Black.
Yeah, and it's one of those things you can understand why some fans would have found this too sharp a left turn away from what season one was, which was essentially, you know, an extension of some of the core ideas behind the X-Files in terms of touchstones, particularly Thomas Harris, the Hannibal novels, you know, Manhunter, that kind of stuff.
The Millennium Group being the Academy Group, yeah. That's
right, exactly. So, you know, that was Chris Carter taking some of the stuff he had in the back of his mind with the X-Files, but then the X-Files veered off. But then Millennium sort of veers back towards a little bit of where the X-Files ended up going, in the sense of it in season two, of it becoming a mythology, and it really establishing itself as a mythology beyond the general ideas that were, you know, the existential ideas of evil and good that were in the first season, but when it was more of a procedural, like you say, crime academy sort of drama.
And you can see that literally here. Like, I mean, Mulder faces the same choice in the X-Files repeatedly that Frank is offered here, which is like, will you throw in your lot with these people, with the forces of darkness? One of the things that I think makes Millennium different from the X-Files is that it makes that conflict more abstract. It frames it in a... And again, this is the thing where Darren's... where I worry I sound ridiculously pretentious, where it frames it in a more writerly way, a more lyrical or more poetic or more abstract manner, where it's like, oh, by the way, when we say, like, the world is going to end, we don't mean in, like, a literal, like, aliens are going to invade and they're going to be called colonists and there's going to be black oil. No, we mean just the world is going to end because God is tired of existence and the forces of hell are going to wage war and, you know, stuff like that. That sort of stuff, like, in a vague sense.
It sort of in a whimper. And that's the whole thing, isn't it? That's, in the X-Files, Mulder is tempted by the smoking man, as in, join us, we will, you know,
we'll give
protect
you, a vaccine.
You, give you the knowledge, we'll give you a vaccine, a literal vaccine. Not just this, you know, existential metaphorical idea of the truth that Mulder's seeking, but, you know, but a literal safeguard.
Tangible, like, hold
the death, yeah, from the apocalypse that is literally going to happen. Whereas in this, Frank is told to just don't do anything. You know, he's what they want him to do is nothing. You know,
that
Crocell says it. He says, you know,
it's easy.
Anyone
everybody
can do it.
Most people do.
Most people do. Yeah, and that is one of the most beautiful and disturbing lines, because it's true. You know, and that's one of the things. And it is very much an idea that if Frank doesn't have to go and do all of these things in the way Mulder literally would, he just doesn't have to do anything. And that's an amazing concept, really, if you think about it. You know, you're actively, your mythology is trying to get a character to give up his quest and to become a completely placid, you know, neutral kind of character, you know. And in any kind of narrative, the idea, a good narrative, is a character who is always on a journey. He's always going forward. There's always momentum. Whereas Millennium literally wants Frank to stop his momentum and essentially kill its own idea. And that's brilliant. In that is a level of genius about this episode and that choice, that existential choice Frank gets, you know, to help evil win. He just doesn't do anything.
Yeah,
he doesn't even have to do anything
quote,
bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's fantastic, and it's a really different, and you're absolutely right, it's not pretentious at all. It is much more of an abstract concept about how the apocalypse happens, you know, apathy, lack of, you know,
who cares?
Who cares? And that's the genius of this episode, and it's brilliantly shown through Crocell. And I have to mention what I think is one of the best examples of visual storytelling ever. I think that the scene in which young Frank goes to Crocell's house, that scene is majestic, because Frank, and brilliant bit of mirroring in that young Frank barely says anything to Crocell, and then old Frank barely says anything to Crocell. It is a complete symbolic, you know, identical sort of scene in many ways. But that scene then tells you everything about Crocell, even though he's talking about stuff. He's talking about abstract stuff. You see the fact he's been reading The Age of Reason. You know the time period, because the newspaper says that Hermann Göring's just shot himself.
You even have the German, like the eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a German by the toe. Frank dressed up like a soldier as well, to give you a sense of context for it as well. Yeah,
right. See the picture on the wall of the soldiers in the war in which Crocell is there. And it's just Frank looking at all these things. He's a child. He doesn't understand the context. He doesn't really know what any of this means. But we do. And we're picking it up. And you immediately know that Crocell is this broken man, destroyed by the war. He's lost all of his comrades. He's probably got PTSD. He is suicidal. He has nothing to live for. And he's been and all the kids in the neighborhood think he's this scary dude who doesn't clean, you know, stuff off his window because he's just that apathetic. He's given up, and it is amazing. That is amazing storytelling. If I was teaching narrative, I would absolutely use this episode, and I would use that scene and say, "This is how you show and not tell. This is perfect way of doing it." And I think it's every time I watch it, I'm like, this is just wow. It just wows me, Darren, every single time.
And that's the beauty of the episode. Again, this is the thing where I was worried a little bit about sounding pretentious, but I think this is what the second season of Millennium does so very, very well, is that it takes these big abstract concepts. Because, you know, Crocell never says, you know, I was in the war, I watched my buddies die in my hands, you know, I the Germans came, it was a massacre. He never says any of that stuff. Instead, what he says is this kind of abstract, metaphorical, kind of like, you know, battle of good and evil and ghosts and kind of abstract concepts. But what you see, because you piece it together, is that what he's actually doing is he's articulating something that is much more relatable, much more mundane, and much more grounded. And again, like I talked about Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions with Chris Knowles in the first season, and his reading on it was fantastic. He argued that like one of the ways that you can read Millennium's arc, and one of the reasons why Millennium's sort of like spiritual arc doesn't make as much sense to the X-Files mythology, is because you could read it as Frank subjectively trying to make sense of all the terrible things that have happened to him by casting it as a mythological battle between good and evil, as like writing over reality as he's seen it by imposing this sort of abstract narrative, you know? And again, you know, obviously, as the show develops, like the X-Files, it becomes very hard to believe that, you know, it not everything that's happening is perfectly rational. You literally see demons sitting down to coffee at one point in the show's run. But, like, you can if you want to read it that way. And that's what I really love about the second season of Millennium, is that, like, it does have this kind of very abstract, very vague, very messy, very sort of like, you know, good and evil are fighting in the world and the apocalypse is happening and it's going to be the end of the world and it's going to wreck it. You know, it's going to be the destruction of absolutely everything on a scale that exists beyond human comprehension. But all of that is really just a kind of a way of mythologizing a very human and a very simple and a very understandable journey, which is Frank has lost his family. This is a man who built his entire identity around this one facet of himself, and that one facet has been pulled away from him. And it's like removing, you know, one of those pieces from a Jenga board. You know, the whole thing is going to quake and it's all going to come apart. And you can argue that it's because of forces outside, but it's really because that load-bearing piece is gone. And again, I'm wary of like being too, you know, really personal or anything like that on that. But I think that, you know, I've been through moments like that personally. I have been through moments where it feels like everything that I've done has amounted to, you know, not as much as I would have hoped. And everything that I hoped would come together hasn't clicked into place. And it does. And again, this sounds so melodramatic and so over the top, but it does, or at least it did for me, and again, maybe it's because I was a teenager when I was watching it, or as a young man, and I didn't have perspective and distance, but it does feel sometimes when something like that goes wrong, when something so fundamental or something that you've taken for granted disappears. And all of that happens to Frank over the course of the season. We'll talk about it as we go through. I'm not going to talk about spoilers because I know a lot of people are listening, you know, on a first-time watch, so I'm not going to go into too many details. But if you've seen it before, you know exactly what I'm talking about, all the stuff that happens to Frank between now and the end of the season. Frank loses these parts of himself that he considers important and essential. And those are the end of his world. Like, in a very, as much as it feels like it is the end of the world. And like Krosal talks about things like ghosts and demons, and he talks about hauntings, and he talks about, you know, abstract concepts to explain this, like, gaping pain inside of himself in a very, you know, if you were being cynical, you'd say pretentious or artsy sort of way, but I think a very human way, because we extrapolate a lot of what we understand, how we understand the world, from ourselves, from our own perception of the world. And so when we are falling to pieces, we typically, you know, the world seems to be falling to pieces around us. And I think that that plays the entire season, and you're right that it's a phenomenal piece of storytelling, because in that one scene with Krosal, you have a microcosm of the entire season storytelling with Frank. And by the way, it's a lovely touch that it ends with Krosal, having said, "I'll find a treat for you," offering Frank a cigarette. And again, you have this kind of metaphor. Yeah. Cigarettes, you know, in the X-Files, obviously being a metaphor for corruption. But again, throughout, like, pop culture, cigarettes are something, it's, you know, it's an addictive habit. It's passed from one person to another. And so you have this idea that, you know, he's handed Frank this cigarette, which is addictive, which he will get hooked on, you know, which he could get hooked on. And it's something that's corrosive, and it's something that's poisonous, and something that we know is toxic now. And this idea that, you know, down the line, Frank is going to be having the exact same doubts that Krosal had in that house all those years ago, and he couldn't make sense of it as a child. Can he make sense of it as an adult? And can we make sense of it as well?
I think as well, that's why it's great that it touches on the idea that Frank is becoming an urban legend, you know, himself. And there's that scene which, to some extent, I suppose, could feel the most disposable and cheeky moment of the episode, in which he goes down to the basement and there's this guy. It reminded me a little bit of the opening of Die Hand, Die Verletzt, where the guys take the girls to the forest, which is again a Glenn Morgan and James Wong episode in the X-Files, and they take the girls to the forest and they're trying to summon a demon to try and, you know,
impress,
top off with these girls, and then they actually do and one of them dies. And in this case, they conjure Frank back, and he's telling the story of Frank Black in the house where the detective was murdered. And it's great because it's retelling everything that actually did happen in Lamentation, you know, with Lucy Butler, with Bob Bletcher, through the prism of these teenage kids who, you know, in these days it would be something on, you know, Creepypasta, you know, it'd be on Reddit, you know, this urban legend story. But back then, it's passed down orally through the neighborhood, through these kids. You know, this old house, this beautiful house that's sort of now, you know,
abandoned,
and left, and they can get in the basement, and you do get the great comic episode, and he goes, "Frank was never seen again, unless you look over here." You know, and it is cheeky, it is a little bit indulgent, but I think it also sort of underscores where Frank is again, and you get that great moment where he literally says, "Bob, I'm here. Prove to me that there is more to this world and that you can hear me." And, you know, if ever there was an episode, I think, where, well, he sort of does see a sort of shadow that might be Bob's ghost, doesn't he? It's like a shadow on the wall. But I think if ever there was an episode that maybe could have got away with you seeing Bill Smitrovich again, you know, it would have been this. But I just think that's great. I think that throwing that in, just, it again sort of shows that Frank is, he's so far away from where he was at the beginning, you know, in this episode, and that he's got a long way to go yet before he gets back to where he wants to be.
Yeah, and again, you have that thing where Frank is, and you mentioned that is mythologizing Frank, where you have this sort of gather round and let us sit up on the ground and tell sad stories of, you know, the death of cops. But you have this, you know, idea of, you have Frank Black who's become an urban legend, but you have him playing into that as well. And so you have this kind of, and again, this is a push and pull that happens throughout the second season, where you have the question of, like, how much is Frank going to buy into the mythology of Millennium? How much is he going to invest? How much is he going to believe in all of this strange stuff that's happening? And you have that moment, you point out the moment where he's like, you know, Bob, if you're there, this is the moment to tell me. Where you have the sense of Frank wanting to believe in that more, that leap, that something greater. And kind of the sense in which, you know, almost the second season seems to argue that doing that is dangerous, you know, that if Frank begins to buy into that stuff, you know, and again, you have Peter Watts, who is the obvious kind of like point of contrast. We mentioned like he's not in this episode, but throughout the season, Peter and Frank are kind of two sides of the same coin, where Peter has entirely kind of thrown into this idea of mythologizing. He's bought into the Millennium Group. You know, he talks about finding the baby in the cooler, and that kind of bookends the season, this idea of like of evil and needing to believe in something more than just kind of people, more than just like inherent people being awful. There has to be something more significant to the world. And with the Curse of Frank Black, you have that with Frank, where he's kind of, you wonder, is he buying into that, transforming himself into the urban legend? And also, I love the line, leave the suds. Of course he is. Frank is from the 50s. They still call them suds back then.
leave the suds.
But, and you point out that moment where you kind of see the shadow of Bletcher on the wall. There's a wonderful moment later on, I think it's in the same sequence, where he goes upstairs and where he leaves the house, where there's the flash of lightning, and it's, you know, you have the kind of the cloth or the bed sheet draped over the banister, and it does look almost like a ghost in some of those sequences. And you have even, like, again, when, you know, later on when he throws eggs at the house, you have the demon face that appears in them. But even when he's cleaning the house, you have the demon in the background through the suds, but it's gone when it's cleared there. You have a lot of this stuff with perception, which is very, very good and very effective. Because I like that the episode doesn't give you anything as clear-cut as a shot of Bletcher, you know, standing there in the shadows like he did in Powers, Fatalities, Thrones, and Dominions. I like that there's a sense of, you know, are we actually seeing this? Is this just a coincidence? Is this just patterns? Is this how human brains work, where we have, you know, where we see shapes and we have to assemble them into faces because that's pattern recognition, because that makes a crazy universe make sense? I like that aspect of the episode a lot, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of this kind of episode makes me, and with this is something we will talk about eventually on The Time Is Now and on the X-Cast, in fact, but it makes me even sadder that we didn't really get the crossover that we should have got between these two shows, in which we really have more of a Frank-centric idea, you know, and sort of a blending of these two sort of mythologies together. Because in the, you know, this episode is, I mean, the reading that Chris Knowles gave of that it could be Frank's sort of subjective way of figuring stuff out.
Having a nervous breakdown,
It's fascinating, that is, and I'd never considered that. And that's an amazing reading of this whole thing.
Well, I think there are episodes in the second season where it very strongly leans in that direction. I think that, you know, like Luminary, for example, is very strongly in that direction, I would argue.
Luminary, in some sense, is the next major step on this journey, you know, after this. But if you kind of look at this episode from a literal point of view, there is a lot of supernatural stuff going on. All through this episode, he's being guided by fate, essentially. All the numbers, you know, the Acts of the Apostles, 26:8. You know, he sees 268 everywhere, on the telly, on the backs of the boys, you know, in their jersey shirts, you know, on his radio, you know, there is a radio that the song plays, the little demon, oh, little demon, that kind of thing, right? And he takes the batteries out and it still plays, you know, and there's lots of little things in there that are completely supernatural that are absolutely defy explanation. And it's not the kind of story that folk dwells on that, like the X-Files would try and find a rational explanation or have that kind of thing. But I wish we'd have had some blending of those two ideas, because Millennium Season 2 really does, you know, you said it earlier, it does unequivocally, it is unequivocally supernatural at various different points. You know, it is more abstract, but there are definitely things in there that you can't get away from, you know?
Yeah, and there's no way that owls and roosters is just a conspiracy theory. Like,
no.
Just some misunderstandings involving dynamite and assassination, apparently.
But I think that's fascinating, in that it really does sort of it starts to fuse these overarching world. And I think were these shows being made now, they would be very different beasts, obviously. But were they being made now, I think you would have had more of a concerted effort to try and tie things together. And it might not have been as good. I mean, the reality is that I think one of the reasons this does work is even though these two shows are technically in a shared universe, they both are strong enough to tell their own stories, and they don't cross over. They don't try and weave everything together. You know, we don't find out that, you know, Crocell was actually a Grey from, you know, and he's part of Purity Control. You know, it's not that. So on the one hand, I'm saying that. On the other, I like the fact it's abstract. I like the fact it's mythical. I like the fact it's telling more of us like a dark fairy tale in that sense. But I think my point is that there are lots of things in this episode that are literally changed the fabric of what Millennium is, and it's the first time it's ever really done this, you know, in this way, and that's why it sort of stands out as well.
Yeah, it's just a staggeringly confident piece of television. I said that there was no way that I thought the show could do this beforehand, and then, like, you know, three episodes down the line or four episodes down the line, you have Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, which is completely off the wall. And then, like, as you get towards the end of the season, you start having like the Frank, you know, an episode without Frank in it, which would have been unimaginable up until that point. You have an episode which is an anthology episode with four demons in it, and then you also have Patti Smith Presents The End of the World, which is like, again, tell me that television could have done this. And again, this is like, I watched the first season of Twin Peaks, and, you know, the Zen Art of Catching a Killer was mind-blowing to me as well. But again, this is something similar, or it was something similar to Teenage Me, because it was like, you can do this on television?
Yeah.
And like, the network will actually give you money? It's amazing. And again, like, part of me wonders how much they got away with, because Fox were like, we have no idea what's going on here.
That's about what I was about to say. I think had people been watching this show more, they never would have got away with stuff like that. They never would have done like a 10-minute, you know, Laura Means loses her mind to Patti Smith sequence, which is just an incredible, incredible piece of TV. And there's so many things across this whole season that are like that. So many of these stories, so many of these ideas that, you know, were things being more micromanaged from above, probably would never have happened. And that's the beauty of this. This whole season feels magical. It feels rare. It feels like something that you have two creatives at the top of their game. I mean, I don't think they've ever done anything better, Morgan and Wong. And they've done great stuff over the years, and they've had peaks and troughs of their career, and they're still talented guys now. But I don't think anything touches this in terms of just the sheer creativity and magical, you know, vision of this. And this, you know, the Curse of Frank Black for me is the apex of it, even though there are some amazing 10 out of 10s to come. This is my 10 out of 10 out of 10 out of 10, you know, because because it is, like you said, astonishingly confident and beautiful. And I mean, you know, and by the end, I've got goosebumps. That whole sequence after the Crocell conversation, where Frank goes back downstairs and he's just staring at the monitor, which is bleeping, and there are 780 days remaining or whatever. But it has the confidence just to slowly push forward towards the computer as Lance Erickson's just staring at this screen. Just the fact it takes its time and builds suspense, builds mood, builds atmosphere is so rich and just fantastically done that, I mean, I know I'm gushing. I know I sound really, like, ridiculous, but I just think this is amazing. I think this is perfection. I really do think this is TV perfection.
And even in that kind of slow push in on the monitor with the Ouroboros flashing and there are 790 days remaining, even within that shot, you have so much because you have the little post-it stamp, the stick-it note on the screen reminding Frank that he has custody of Jordan between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. for trick-or-treating. But no, but again, like, that's the thing. That's the end of Frank's world. Like, it's not the Ouroboros. It's not the actual Millennium. As far as Frank's concerned, the end of the world is the loss of his family, and that's the custody of Jordan, the reminder that you have there as the camera's pushing in. And you have the two elements in the same shot. shot, which is just, again, remarkably confident visual storytelling that tells you everything that you need to know. And like, just to bring it back to Krosil for a moment, and one of the things that I really, really like about this episode, and again, this is the thing, and again, we are gushing. Let's gush properly. No half-assing this. Is that, again, and this gets at the weird thing where it is heightened, it is melodramatic, it is abstract, but it's also entirely relatable, because like the X-Files has always been built around the idea, and again this is something Carter's done repeatedly, where Carter's idea of evil is something insidious and something infectious, but it's also based largely on action. So like, you know, in those early episodes, the black oil gets into you and it makes you do terrible things. In Empedocles, evil passes from person to person and it makes you do terrible things. But even in the X-Files, when you make deals with the devil, again, you know, the cigarette-smoking man, as we discussed, is a kind of a metaphorical devil in the world of the X-Files. But what the cigarette-smoking man demands of people like Skinner is actual action, actual complicity. Like, think of Zero Sum, for example, where Skinner's, you know, deal with the cigarette-smoking man isn't just stand back and do nothing. It's like, no, action. I need you to do this stuff for me very particularly. And what I really, really like, and you kind of alluded to this earlier when you talked about that wonderful monologue from Dean Winters, you know, who here establishes himself as possibly the worst boyfriend that Liz Lemon actually ever had, which is quite an accomplishment. But you have this sort of moment with Krosil where he talks about how what he wants Frank to do, he doesn't want Frank to throw in. He doesn't want Frank to actually help the forces of evil. And I mean, even in the first season, you have that episode, Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions, where like Pepper implies that like working for evil is like a full-time job in which you are always evil all the time and always on retainer. And like, you know, helping people beat murder raps and stuff like that. Whereas Krosil, and this is what really elevates, you know, the episode for me and really sells me on the second season as a whole. Krosil's idea of, and you mentioned earlier, Krosil's idea of what evil is just standing back and doing nothing. It's that Burke theory, that Edmund Burke kind of line about all it takes for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. But it's this idea of being passively complicit, of like the moment that you stop trying, the moment that you give up, the moment that you just give in, the moment that you just stop fighting, stop trying to do what makes you you. And, you know, and again, it's you don't have to necessarily be trying to make the world a better place, in inverted commas. You just have to be trying to live your life in a way that is true to who you are. The moment that you stop doing that is the moment in which evil wins and the moment in which your apocalypse happens. It doesn't have to be an active thing. You don't have to, like, take it out. You don't have to dismantle anything. You don't have to, like, tear it apart. It's an act of, like, Frank. And then this is the thing that I absolutely love about the Curse of Frank Black. It's the moment where Frank, all this pent-up aggression and rage and all this anger that he's feeling inside himself, and he does feel anger, and it is palpable, and it's a tremendous performance from Henriksen. Like, he is angry. He has lost something, and he feels that anger inside himself. He goes outside, he grabs the eggs, and he throws them at the house. And, like, in most stories, like, that would be a point of, like, that would be the moment at which you are condemned. That would be the point at which you cross a threshold. It's a moment at which you kind of take up eggs and you decide that you want to dismantle this thing that you've done. What I really love about The Curse of Frank Black, and what I think makes it really kind of humanist and kind of warm and very affirming, is that for The Curse of Frank Black, Frank throwing those eggs, Frank having that moment of weakness, Frank doing that thing is not evil. If Frank were to leave that stuff there, if Frank were to not try anymore, if Frank didn't get up in the morning, get in his car, and clean the windows off, and try to go back about being who he was and doing what's important to him, that would be evil. That passiveness, that accepting of the world as broken and flawed and kind of, you know, irredeemable, that's what evil is. That's how evil triumphs. I find something very beautiful in that kind of, like, in that metaphor, because it's not melodramatic. It's not kind of heightened in the way that, you know, well, now you're going to have to cover up a crime scene, Agent, you know, Dr. Skinner. It's like, no, like, if you throw dog crap at your house and leave it there, that's evil as one. It's like, it's okay for you to throw dog crap, but you have to pick up the pieces afterwards, because that's actual work. Your life is just maintenance, you know, like, being good is an act of maintenance. It's an act of kind of constant cleaning up after yourself. What's it called? Ethical hygiene or moral hygiene, I think, is the description of it. And I find something, I think that's an interesting sort of theory, and I think it works really well here, and I've always really loved that about the episode.
That's kind of the message, isn't it, really, that to live your life and to be a, you know, a functioning person and a functioning human being and, you know, attempt to get on with it is the message as to how you do keep going, as to how you do keep, you know, good in the world, if you like, if you want to go, you know, like you say, in that melodramatic way. But that's it. It is the apathy is what creates a lot of the awful things in the world. You know, in some respects, it's not to get too present, but it is quite apt, because I'd say that the general apathy amongst, you know, particularly Western civilization has led to a lot of the problems that we're currently experiencing now, which weren't there in the 90s or were bubbling away in the 90s or were seeded, you know, in previous decades, previous generations. And it's that whole thing of, you know, it's why so many people clamor these days for Millennium to make a comeback, you know, fans of it, because there feels like it feels like we're in a time, particularly now, where we could do with Frank Black, we could do with that nobility, we could do with that center, that rock, that moral authority. You know, it's another reason why I think people are so excited for the return of Jean-Luc Picard, because he's a similar character in a very different world. He's a similar character. You know, they are strong older men who represent moral, you know, fortitude, humanity, a deep-rooted humanity, and who you feel would keep you safe, would protect you, you know. And Frank, that's the great thing about Frank.
But are also active as well. Again, like, you know, Picard explored, Picard led, and Frank Black does the same thing. Frank Black is defined by the fact that, you know, he goes out into the world. He actively leaves the house, you know?
Yeah, and that's it. That's why, like you say, cleaning up the mess at the end is a beautiful way to end it, really. Just a beautiful ending to a beautiful episode. My favourite episode of Millennium, my favourite episode of TV, and I stand by that, even though I'm aware there is a difference between favourite and objective best. I think trying to find the objective best of anything, whether it's cinema, TV, music, is incredibly difficult.
Well, you would have to consume, you know, everything, which is simply impossible unless you are a machine.
Just impossible.
Yeah.
But I've never watched, and I've seen some fantastic TV, and I've got a list of probably about 10 episodes I consider masterpieces, but I don't think anything makes me as happy or makes me feel as fulfilled as The Curse of Frank Black whenever I watch it. And I think that's the yardstick for me to judge it by, personally. But I just hope it's something that I just want to introduce to as many people as I can. And if they get from it what I do, great. If they don't, they don't. But I think 9 times out of 10, I think people would watch this and go, do you know what? That's good. At the very least, that's good telly, you know. And that'll do for me, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I've watched this with people who have never watched another episode of Millennium, and they seem generally happy with it. I tried showing them the Doomsday Defense, and they found it one of the most obnoxious episodes of television that they had ever seen.
Oh,
I do not agree with that assessment, to be absolutely clear. But
no, I'm one of those heathens who thinks it's better than From Outer Space. Like, ooh, you know, I am. I'm one of those heathens who actually thinks it's the better Rose Chong episode.
Which, we are the hipsters. I like that. We're saying all this on the Millennium podcast, Tony. I dare you to go on the X-Cast and say this.
I would never dare. Like, I value my life. I will have the conspiracy after me in no time. But no, this has been fantastic, Darren.
Thank you.
I've so enjoyed talking through this episode with, as ever, it's a joy to speak to somebody who's so intelligent and learned and loves this stuff as much as I do, if not more. So thanks. It's not the first.
My pleasure. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's not the last season 2 episode we're going to do together, I think, as well. We've got a few more coming up.
I'm really looking forward to that. Oh, we're completing the incomplete Frank Black holiday trilogy, which I quite like.
Yes, we're next going to be together for Midnight of the Century, I think, which I think, well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I think that's another 10, to be honest.
I may have to be a little bit stingier, but I do love the episode.
Okay.
We'll and get, Darren we'll get, is off the episode. Darren's cut.
Yeah,
I'll see you in Siren.
Call your agent. Yeah, you're out. Well, until we're both back for that one in a few weeks' time, where can people find you, Darren, and what are you up to right now?
Cool. Well, you can find me online at Darren_Mooney on Twitter. That is an actual underscore, not the word underscore. The character limit doesn't support that. I am currently writing at The Escapist magazine. I'm writing at The Movie Blog, which is my own website. It has a 0 instead of an O in the word movie because I didn't get there fast enough. And I also co-host a podcast with my friend Andrew Quinn. This episode is going out sort of for patrons, close enough to recording, so I can tell you that if you're a patron listening to this podcast, the next episode will be covering Nadine Lebecki's Caper Now, which is the second Lebanese movie to be nominated for the Best Foreign Film Oscar. The first Lebanese film, as far as I'm aware, to make the 250. And an interesting, grueling, sort of like soul kind of clutching study of child poverty in modern Lebanon. It is worth seeking out, I would contend. If you are not a patron, and if you're listening to this according to regular release schedule, you will have caught us right between our two Exorcist episodes. So last weekend, we would have discussed, yeah, I know, it's literally the only time we could get away with doing this, because it's one of the movies is on the top 250, and the other episode is on the IMDb's bottom 100. I won't tell you which is which, but you can probably guess. but we, to discuss The Exorcist, William Friedkin's Exorcist, which may be either one of the best movies ever or one of the worst movies ever, we invite the
best.
Wonderful I feel like it's not a spoiler to say yes, it didn't make
the
bottom
best.
List yeah. We invite the wonderful Dr. Bernice Murphy, who's written books on the suburban Gothic and the American Gothic. She's one of the great writers on horror fiction and horror media ever. I'm a huge fan, and it was a joy to talk to her about that. Next weekend, we'll be discussing Exorcist 2, The Heretic, which maybe, which is also on one of those two lists. It's the only time we could find a movie and its sequel on the top and bottom. And for that one, we have the wonderful Phil Bagnall from the Scandal Podcast, and Bernice Murphy again joining us to discuss Richard Burton Richard Burton and James Earl Jones in a giant lotus costume.
It is astonishingly bad.
Somebody who only watched
really
it for this podcast, it is something to behold. So that's what I have found at the moment, Tony.
That's fantastic. I can't wait for Exorcist 2, The Heretic. That film is terrible, but that podcast is going to be gold, I think.
I love that, by the way. It's like, yeah, good movie. I'm not here for that.
But yeah, awesome. That's great. And the details of this podcast will be in the credits, but you can find me at my Twitter, at AJ Black Writer. On Facebook, if you type it's AJ Black, you'll find my page. And various bits of writings. There's also plenty of the other podcasts I'm involved with for the We Made This Podcast Network, which we're part of, which include the XCast, which will be coming back for its fifth season very soon, kicking off with which Darren will be on, of course. And Carl Sweeney and I from the XCast have our own movie podcast, Motion Pictures, in which we're talking about various different topics. And as you listen to this, our Brexit, Movies to Brexit by will be out. Which I'm not even joking.
You should have called it the Brexit Club.
Well, oh, we might have to now. You heard that here first, guys. That's genius. So yeah, films that are about or inform the current national political crisis that the UK is in, which as you listen to this will maybe...
close to being resolved as you listen to this live?
Who are we kidding? It's never going to be resolved. We will die in 100 years with this problem still happening. But anyway.
Black couldn't solve Brexit.
No. That would be a challenge even for Frank, wouldn't it, really? Although I'd give him a try. I'd give him a shot. I'd give anything a shot right now. But anyway, until we return for another episode of The Time Is Now, thanks again, Darren. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And remember... this is who we are. The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now, plus we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This Podcast Network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music and beyond, including our sister show The XCast and X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The XCast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXCast. That's patreon.com/TheXCast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.